Storm DJ's podcast.
Welcome to the 31st Storm DJ's podcast. Today we're excited to host Chris Hawkins, celebrated BBC Radio 6 music presenter and the voice behind How to DJ. Chris's journey from a rural village to national radio host is truly inspiring. Join us for a dive into his world of music and find out why DJ booths need urinals.
Thank you for sparing your time today to come on the podcast.
Oh man, I'm really chuffed to be doing this. I was really, really, I feel very lucky to have been asked. Thank you.
Well, no problem at all. And you know, you're a similar position yourself. You've got your podcasts as well going at the moment, haven't you? Can you tell us, just go straight and tell us a bit more about those? And
How to DJ is a podcast which explores life stories, the minds and techniques of much-loved DJs, and that can be radio DJs like myself to big club DJs, and some of them superstar DJs.
Excellent. That's the spirit. That's what we like to hear about. So through the podcast, we're pretty laid back, as you know. We'd basically just go through sort of questions about you, find a bit more about you, your sort of career, and you as a person. It's always been that way, rather than sort of delving into specific music and the rest of it. It's more like you, who's the person behind it all. So we shall delve in, and we shall start with the very basic question of, how did you get started in radio?
So it's very un-rock and roll, my story. I was obsessed by radio as a kid. I used to listen to the radio at night, not just to music radio, to phone-in shows. And I was always fascinated by the one-to-one nature of the medium. And it always felt like the radio, the presenter, was talking to me. And it became an obsession. And I just knew from a very young age, very early teenage years, that I wanted to do radio, but I had no idea how to do it. I grew up in a very, very rural, tiny village in the middle of nowhere in North Shropshire. And I went to a school in the middle of nowhere. So the opportunities were kind of quite slim, really, and no one I knew had ever done anything in the media. So I wrote to my local radio station, BBC Radio Shropshire, and asked to do work experience. And I did 2 weeks. I was young at the time. I remember my mum driving me to and from the station. And I remember at the end of the 2 weeks thinking, I can't just stop here. So I carried on. I kept turning up. It was in the days before security passes, and I just kept walking in the door, and I would do a lot of tea making, a lot of answering phones on shows, and then started to learn to edit on reel-to-reel tape at the time when I was 16, and carried on until I got paid by Radio Shropshire to start driving programs. So I'd learn all of the controls and work my way around the desk, and then ended up on air. The first thing I ever did on air, I can't believe I'm saying it on this podcast because it's so not sexy, but it was, remember I said it was a very rural radio station, I guess in Shropshire. And my first on air job was doing the market prices for sheep and cows at the auction.
Definitely want to remember that one.
I got the bug. I loved it more as time went on. And I was looking at what universities to apply to, and I centered in on Nottingham because I knew that it had a particularly good BBC local radio station. So I applied to go to university in Nottingham just because the radio station was so good. And in fact, I started working at BBC Radio Nottingham before I started at university in Nottingham.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then I remember I was at Nottingham as well. I remember there was quite a sort of sought after campus radio as well there, from what I remember. But did you work with them as well? Or?
No, I didn't. I went in once to meet the team. But I'll be really honest, and I'm glad I don't know who any of them were, because they may all be now very successful radio presenters, producers and bosses. But I was so intimidated that I kind of made my excuses and left and worked at Radio Nottingham for the whole time I was at university. In fact, by my third year, I was presenting the Drive Time show, and I remember leaving a couple of my final exams early to go and do that show.
You said the URN felt intimidating. What was it that was intimidating about that, considering you were sort of flying well above that in terms of your radio career at that stage?
Yeah, I think it's become commonplace to say, but an absolute case of imposter syndrome. Mm. I just didn't feel comfortable in an environment where there was so much camaraderie. There was all the cool going on. And I kind of needed somewhere to learn the job. And I felt like I did American studies at Nottingham, and I did that very purposefully because I needed a degree which allowed me the time to work at in radio at Radio Nottingham. And the truth is that there was no space to do anything more. I was barely at any of my lectures. I had a very, very understanding course secretary who happened to like the show that I did on Radio Nottingham. So she, God bless her, she would let me hand in interviews late and sneak them into the pile because she knew that I was working.
A good connection or good positive person to have on your side, I think, that one.
Yeah, the most important person on my degree course.
Exactly. So going over to the sort of DJing side of stuff, follow naturally from the radio presenting.
So the shows that I did on Radio Nottingham were largely news programs and then followed, when I moved to London, more news shows. And then a mix of music and news. And it was always, my ambition was always to be a national radio presenter on the BBC doing a music show. So I was always into music as a kid. I had Chris's Disco in my mum and dad's garage. There were only ever two people there on the dance floor, my two sisters. I forced them to be there. And I DJed at a nightclub called Park Lane in Shrewsbury doing the under-16s night. I used to DJ at that, and I was barely 16, 17 myself. I remember my mum having to drive me to the nightclub to go and do that. And through university, it was a brilliant time at the Britpop years, and I was starting to get more obsessed with doing a music radio show and got to do that in London, and then Six Music started, and I've been there since the very beginning.
Superb. When you were at Nottingham, did you have any DJ gigs out there as well, or was it more focused around the radio?
No, none at all. No, it was all radio. I mean, I'd go out a lot. I mean, way too much. But
student life.
Yeah, absolute quintessential student life. But no, I didn't DJ until my early 20s in London. There was a club near to where I lived, and I used to DJ in there on a Saturday night. But only in a pretty small time.
Can you remember your first ever one with a real crowd, apart from the one in the house, obviously?
My two sisters.
Yeah.
They still resent me for that, by the way, because it was very much forced upon them. So, it was in that club, an underground club in Royal Oak, which is kind of West London, the end of Westbourne Grove. It was a venue called Anthony's. And I got the bug. I really did. I loved it. I loved the instant reaction. Radio is amazing, more so than ever, because obviously with social media, you are seeing instant reaction to what you're doing. But there is nothing like, I don't think, the feeling of DJing in a venue and seeing faces light up.
Was it a sort of packed dance floor, or what what was this?
Memories fade. Yes. Yeah.
You know, you never forget the first one.
It was all right. It wasn't huge. So I think it was a captive audience.
Mm.
People danced. People had a good time.
That's the key. As long as there's some people dancing, yeah. It doesn't matter.
Well, that's actually, interestingly, that's something I've learned from how to DJ, that actually the science, the art comes after seeing people having a good time. That is the whole intention. Graham Park has been a guest on the podcast, and I remember vividly his words. You know, he's made a living of, dare I say, yeah, near 40-year career out of making people dance and have a good time.
That's basically it, isn't it? It's the key fundamental of it all.
It's the escapism.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Elation.
As we're sort of delving into gigs at the moment, can you describe your best ever gig, or should I say public performance, and why it stands out? I know it could be that you've just got such a blur of everything that you can't remember, but there's usually one or two that sort of stand out.
I mean, some of the more recent ones over the past summer, they're fresh in mind, so I'm going to focus in on Kendall Calling and a headline set on the Friday night. So Kasabian were on the main stage. They'd got a huge crowd, sold out festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on immediately after them. I guess it was 1,500 people, all in the best mood, you know, the start of the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And looking out over that sea of faces, it was incredible. More recently at Manchester Academy, I DJed on a night when the K's, a young band from Manchester who are doing big crowds, and it was 2,500 people up for the best night, and it was unreal. It was an incredible night, a great feeling.
Excellent. And when you're playing out at the moment, how would you describe your style?
Indie pop bangers.
Okay.
Nothing technical.
Yeah.
Nothing too clever. Just stuff that people love.
Excellent. And do you ever get sort of demands, briefs for saying, you know, we want 100 different types of music? And what happens in those sorts of situations? Do you say, I'll stick with my style, or do you veer off towards what they want as well?
I mean, you know, where do you start with that? I try to only do shows that where I'm booked for a particular reason,
mm-hmm.
Rather than fitting with something that is right. out of my comfort zone.
Yeah. Understood. It's the sort of most comfortable way to be, isn't it? Yeah. Rather than being forced into playing tracks that you just that effectively mean nothing to yourself, and you're just like, oh.
Yeah, I like to get lost in a set myself,
mm-hmm.
And feel a part of it. So I've got to love what I'm playing.
Yeah. Going back in time quite far, can you remember your first ever music purchase? And I'm assuming, given time-wise, it could have been vinyl, could have been cassette?
It was a 7-inch vinyl, and it was from Price in Shrewsbury, and I spent my pocket money on Foreigners. I Want to Know What Love Is, you know, that massive, massive American power ballad.
Excellent. Wait, you know, we hear all sorts, but that sounds, you know, quite commendable. There's a lot of quite embarrassing ones that come up, but I like that one.
You've just made me think. It's the first time I've thought about that, hence my hesitation in answering. I'm sort of thinking that, you know, maybe it's time to bring that back as a set closer sometime. Yeah, I still cherish my 7-inch collection. My memory is worse and worse with time, but I can remember where I got every single record I've ever bought.
Wow, that's very impressive.
And where possible through the years, I've always kept the prices on the sleeves and even receipts in the sleeves as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they hold special memories.
Excellent. Yeah, I think with vinyl, because it's so large and so physical, it's probably more of a mental imprint in terms of learning where something came from, whereas the other extreme today, where it's just digital, so it's the other extreme, isn't it?
I had a great moment recently. My 13-year-old daughter has asked for a record player. So the resurgence is very much here.
The physical aspect is just so much more tangible and enjoyable, I think. Whereas if it was all just digital, it's just not all there somehow, is it? I don't know.
There's no sense of ownership.
Exactly.
I think it's not a collection. I love streaming when it's used in the right way. And the practical purpose it serves. I don't love that artists don't get paid properly, or not all artists get paid properly for streaming. But it serves a practical purpose, I think. And it's great to have music at your fingertips, on your phone, whenever you want it. But I do still love, and will always love, the physical, the idea of choosing a record from an actual collection and putting it on a turntable.
And I'm assuming, given that ideally you'd be DJing with vinyl still, but you're probably digital now, I'm assuming. But if you were offered, the full 1210 setup at one of your gigs, would you say, okay, I'll bring a whole crate of vinyl? Or
yeah, I mean, except for the fact that seems to have turned into kind of like a novelty show, and for me personally, it would never be as good. It seems like a lovely romantic idea, but the secret DJ talks, as he does in his book, a lot about lugging round, massive record bags and bags getting lost on flights and sweating on the way to venues in Ibiza, dehydrated with these ridiculous oversized bags of plastic.
It was heavy. How do you think AI is going to impact the DJ industry over the next few years?
What do you think?
I think it's going to have a big impact on the production side of stuff. In terms of people literally being able to produce a track within minutes, fully mastered, ready to go out, and being signed off by AI in terms of how, the rhythm structure and how the harmonics and everything work perfectly. That's what I'm seeing is going to be a big changer. I don't think people really want robots yet in terms of the actual performing DJ, but you never know what could happen.
No, I agree with you. Remember when holograms became a thing, and I guess the ABBA show is an example of what is possible in terms of performance. Who knows how it's going to play out? You're right, replicating and creating perfect pop songs has never been easier. I think that the human touch is vital. I worry most for, I suppose, artists and the detrimental effect it could have on the industry and the ability for artists to earn a living.
Revenue from artist work, it's always been an issue, hasn't it? And it's only going to get worse. My personal opinion on that is that the performance side of stuff is going to be more and more important for them, in terms of if you produce a certain amount of stuff, then you've got to get out and perform and perform that stuff mixed with other stuff, whatever, to get essentially paid where you wouldn't normally get paid just for people streaming stuff. In an ideal world, the streams will generate lots of revenue, but as it stands, that's not the case unless you're, I don't know, someone Ed Sheeran, where you just blasting through a number of streams and you get a decent amount of money from it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because whenever I talk to bands, particularly new bands, I talk to them about how it's never been more important to go out and play live. For most bands, not Ed Sheeran or Taylor Swift, but for most artists, most bands, the live is their living. It's ticket sales and then it's merch.
Yeah.
And so artists, bands have never had to get out and play live as much as that they need to now, ever. It's vital. It's really, really important. And that, so in answer to your question about AI, I think that still nothing can beat the actual being there in person, the real life.
Yeah, and that's it. In terms of the good old pandemic days, did that have any impact on you? Because I know, obviously, mostly based on radio, it theoretically wouldn't have adjusted much. But as it's within entertainment space, you know, that industry was majorly affected. So how did it affect you?
It didn't really affect my day-to-day working life because I was still in the studio. I'm based in Manchester at Media City in Salford. Normally, it would be myself and two producers in the studio together. That wasn't possible. There was obviously everything to do with distancing had its own effect. But the day-to-day was much the same. The roads were a lot quieter. There were a lot less people around Media City, which is normally a buzzing kind of hub. But the radio became, I think it's probably not too much of a stretch to say that it became kind of a lifeline for a lot of people. Mm. There were a lot of people at home and a lot of people on their own at home. So right back to the start of this conversation about radio being a one-to-one medium, I think the messages we were getting into the shows every single day through that whole period, I think the overarching message was, it was people saying thank you and talking about how vital it was, that friend at the end of the radio, the music, that six music that we were playing was a great distraction from the news, which was obviously all bad for a very long time.
And did you find yourself sort of, I suppose, within BBC, you had to try not to express too much emotion or opinion about certain decisions and politics and stuff while you were there?
Yeah. You know, Six Music, it is a, you know, we are a music, music radio station. Our place through that time was never to offer opinion. It was to offer support and distraction. You know, that was vital. So enthusing about music is what we do, because we are as Six Music DJs in an extremely privileged position, and that is to be able to play music that we just absolutely love on a day-to-day basis, and to share that passion is an incredible feeling. And that's where I think Six Music kind of did so much good during the pandemic for our audience. I think we really were a way of them escaping from all that was going on around us all. And the fear of the unknown. So at least we, and hence why being in the studio, we were a constant rather than working from home, and doing shows from home that sounded oddly different, which is what a lot of radio stations were forced to do. I think the consistency of being on the radio in the normal way, albeit with perhaps a slightly altered tone, because you got to remember that, you know, the show that I do, you know, there is no act. It's me and my real life. I get up at 4 in the morning, and I sound at 5 o'clock when the show starts. How you would expect someone that hasn't had much sleep, that got up at 4 a.m. would sound. There's it's a show, but it's very much just that me and what you hear is what you get, what, you know.
Given that time frame, does that mean that your bedtimes are quite early, or how does that work?
Yeah, I go to bed at child's bedtime. My daughter has now overtaken me. So for many years, you know, I would go to bed just a bit after putting her to bed, and then at around the same time. And now she's a young teen. She's now actually going to bed after me. I have a routine. If I'm not working in the evenings, which can be the case, for a lot of the summer just gone, I was doing a lot of work through the weeks, weekday nights. But on a normal day, I'm up at 4, in work and on air for 5. And after the show, we have a couple of hours of working on the next day and various other production stuff. And I try, if I can, to get a short sleep at lunchtime. I remember once, actually, it was amazing. I got invited to a garden party at Buckingham Palace because I'm an ambassador for the Prince's Trust. And Prince Charles, as he was then, King Charles, asked me about the hours and how manage them. And kind of in an anxious moment, I said, well, I fall asleep with loose women every day. I just happened to find a slot at that time of day that works for me to be able to grab like half an hour, 40 minutes. And that show always sends me to sleep. So it works for me. And then I go to bed at 8, try and get at least 6 hours sleep if I can.
Excellent. And when you wake up so early, have you got a sort of routine for that? Like, how do you possibly get out of bed that early? I can't even visualize it.
No, and I don't really know. my alarm goes off. I only set my phone alarm. I just have that one alarm. I guess I've been doing it a long time. I'm kind of attuned to springing kind of out of bed at that time. I stand up sometimes in the shower. I'm never sure if I'm fully awake. I think I probably even cry a little bit in the shower some days when I'm really tired. And then it's a bit of a drive to work. I live in Wilmstow in Cheshire, and then drive into Salford. Once we're in the building, once we're there, and the show starts, we're properly in the zone, and it feels great.
Excellent.
Most of the time, if I'm not hungover.
Have you ever had it where you've had an evening gig and then had to do the first thing in the morning one as well?
Yeah. They're always terrible shows. It can be kind of good if you've been to and doing something that you're really excited to talk about and to share. That's the positive. It can be really tough, though, pulling through on, like, you know, sometimes it can have been as little as minutes sleep. You know that feeling when you go to an airport really early and you're with other people and you kind of have those kind of grunted, sort of awkward conversations? That is how it is every day when my producer and I arrive and we have broken conversations. But once the show's up and running, it kind of, as I say, it feels almost normal. And I think the audience are sympathetic. They understand, you know. It's a real person who is tired.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is essentially the craziest, how unique and crazy do you think you are?
Yeah, used to be maybe even a 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
and left London because of the 10 these days.
It's scaled down a bit since then, has it?
Yeah. Yeah, it had to. So life now is in a small town in Cheshire, and I go out a fair bit. I see a lot of live music, but it's on a manageable scale. Mm-hmm. So I would probably reluctantly say I'm probably a very average and I would say even boring 6 or 7. Seven on a good weekend.
Seven's still got some spice to it. That's good. What's something that you're not very good at but wish you were?
Football.
Okay.
I am because I'm a massive Shrewsbury Town fan, and I still, you know, it for a long time I took my boots to games thinking I played as a kid and I was mascot for Shrewsbury once. I never missed
it. You're the mascot, were you?
Yeah, but not like the dressing up in the little boy who...
Okay, you know, I see. I was imagining some sort of furry creature.
Yeah, I've never been a furry creature. I was mascot. I mean, that's what it was called. I just always dreamt, if I hadn't done the radio, of playing for Shrewsbury Town. And still, I still have those dreams. I still, whenever I go to a game, I still can see myself on the pitch. I'm left-footed. I'm right-handed, left-footed. I always thought that would be a good reason why they might need me sometime.
Yeah, an advantage of sorts, I suppose. But
The phone never rang.
Share a belief or opinion that you hold that might be unconventional. Don't worry, not on the BBC at the moment.
Urinals in DJ booths, I think. No?
Yeah, but then you'd have to, it would have to be in front of an audience, unless it's sort of hidden underneath. Or is that what you're imagining, just underneath where all the wires and cables are?
There's got to be a way somehow. I mean, there has. I was at a venue a little while back, and it was so far to the toilet, and I had to go. I had admittedly drunk quite a lot of beer during the set that I was doing, but it was quite a long set. And it felt like a very long way downstairs to the back of a basement room. And then like a breath run back up to the DJ booth. I mean, maybe it's not like an actual urinal, but some way of dealing with that issue.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe just a port-a-loo in your rider.
Been looking up at the stairs. I don't know how that could happen, but I think it would be so welcome.
Definitely. Like, I can sort of agree with that. I just can't quite visualize it. Describe your ideal sandwich and what goes into it.
This presumably should be a really clever answer.
It could be as clever or as dumbed down as you want.
I'm a really fussy eater, so that doesn't give me many options. I'm going to say bacon sandwich, brown sauce, because it's the sandwich that I have most, because the hours, and Greg's at Media City in Salford does very good business with me.
Oh, very good. A little plug for Greg's. What about the bread? I mean, is that just white bread? Or...
Yeah, because it has to be, right? A bacon sandwich.
I'm not to judge.
No, you're watering the product down if it's not. It's bacon on white brown sauce. That is a bacon sandwich.
Yeah, pure and simple. Can't argue with that. Then, if you had to pick a final track for the end of the world party before AI takes over the world and that's the end of it all, what would your track be?
Whoa. One track.
Yeah. Maybe that first vinyl that you bought.
I Want to Know What Love Is. Those three songs would be different each day of the week in answer to that question, depending on mood. Mm-hmm. And like any kind of DJ set, you read the room. So it's the end of the world. I'm going to say, I think it's one of the greatest songs ever written. And I just love that song. But I think perhaps more fitting, another one of the greatest songs of all time. So I'm going to go with Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, Feel. All right, that is my final answer. Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
Do you want to phone a friend?
No, that's the one. That's okay. Yeah.
That is the correct answer. Well done. Excellent. At this stage, obviously, we've got to move onwards, but I thank you very much for joining us today. Can you remind the listeners where to hear you and see you and get hold of you and your podcasts again? I know we went over it vaguely at the start, but just say it again now so everyone remembers.
For sure. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on. This, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Pleasure.
So my daily show is on BBC Radio 6 Music, which is on the radio, on BBC Sounds and Smart Speaker. And that's every morning, every weekday morning on 6 Music. And the podcast is How to DJ. That's at podfollow.com/How to DJ. Past guests include Judge Jules and Greg Wilson, Utah Saints, Carl Cox, Oakenfold, Jeremy Healy, Sarah Story, Greg James. The list goes on. I've been very lucky. So many great guests. And DJing out, that'll be best followed on my socials.
In our post online, I'll make sure we add all the links in there for you as well. I'd like to have a listen to that one with Judge Jules, actually, because I know that he moved back into the sort of legal, he started in the legal area, went into DJing, and now he's gone back into legal. Is that sort of correct, or am I just making things up there?
No, you've remembered exactly right. So on the day that we recorded the interview, I was in London at Tile Yard Studios, amazing setup there. in North London, and Jules had come in. He was a little bit late because he was dealing with a case.
Okay.
And he was straight. So he got into to his DJ brain and talks about stuff so enthusiastically, so passionately about the music that he loves and his amazing journey. And then went straight back to fighting a legal case.
Superb. He was one of my most listened to DJs when I was at Nottingham, actually, on the radio. It's just Judge Jules and Pete Tong.
Jules is one of, I think, probably, is he not one of the most famous DJs ever, I would say?
Yeah, definitely.
DJs as we know them today have not actually been around for that long.
Mm. It's very true. There's a lot of fresh faces on the scene that sort of taking up all the top, what's it called? It's the DJ Mag Top 100 list, where it's so many names on there. You think, okay, they definitely haven't been around very long, but it's a moving chart, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I Richard Serling was a guest on the podcast, and he is a Northern Soul DJ, and he did Wigan Casino 50 years ago.
Wow.
So he would be, you know, a prototype, I guess, because those Northern Soul nights were absolutely massive. No mixing, just playing great songs,
getting the people dancing,
everyone
dancing. Excellent. Well, Chris, thank you very much again, and we will hopefully catch up soon.
Storm DJ's podcast.